Welcome to Introduction to International Relations. If you haven't already, you should download the slides that accompany this lecture and scroll down past the title page to the first actual slide, where you'll find the three goals for this first lecture. First, I'm going to take a little time to discuss what Introduction to International Relations is all about, the sorts of questions we'll be asking, as well as the ones we won't be. I'm then going to set up the rest of the module by presenting two puzzles, which will be the focus of many future lectures. My primary goal with this module is to explain why we don't see more cooperation and less conflict than we do. Hopefully, you'll learn more than that along the way, but if, by the end of the term, you've understood why those are important questions to ask and have a decent grasp on the answers I've provided, then I'll have done my job. So I've already given you some sense of what this module is all about, but let's clarify that a bit more. Turn to the second slide. As you can see there, international relations is sometimes referred to as IR for short. Depending on whom you ask, IR is either a subfield of political science, that's the mainstream view in the United States, where you can tell I'm from, or its own separate field of inquiry, which I gather is the way people tend to see things here in the UK. That's probably not important to most of you, but it could be worth knowing, and if you hear me refer to IR at some point in the future, as I'll likely do through force of habit, you'll know what I mean. Incidentally, IR is also sometimes referred to as international or world politics. Some people have strong preferences over which term to use, and while I could get in trouble for saying these arguments are a bit overblown, they really are. All three refer to the same thing. As long as you know what sorts of questions the subfield hopes to answer and which lay outside its purview, it doesn't really matter what you call it. So what sorts of questions does IR hope to answer? Well, broadly speaking, IR concerns itself with interactions between states and the attempts of non-state actors to influence the foreign policies of their own governments or any policy, foreign or domestic, of one or more foreign governments. There was a whole lot in there. Let's unpack that a bit. First of all, a state is a political entity. That's just one of several concepts the word country might refer to. So when I refer to states, I'm referring to countries, but in a very specific sense, because country can also refer to cultural entities, more formally known as nations. Sometimes people even refer to nation states, though they probably shouldn't, because that term implies a degree of overlap between people's shared sense of identity and the internationally recognized boundaries of a government's legal authority that is surprisingly rare. That probably only made things worse, huh? Okay, let's take an example. What country is the University of Essex in? As I recently discovered, trying to explain things to my relatives in the US, the answer to that simple question can be quite confusing for many people. If you interpret that question as asking which state the University of Essex is in, the answer is the UK, short for the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. But you could also say England, and in some sense, be correct. England is not a state, however. It was, at one time, and it retains a separate sense of identity compared to other nations within the UK, such as Scotland or Wales, both of which are also British, but that doesn't make it a state. England is not represented at the United Nations. It is not a party to different military alliances and trade agreements than Scotland or Wales, or Northern Ireland, which may or may not constitute its own nation, depending on who you ask. Arguably, its people are linked by national identity as well as geography to the Republic of Ireland. Anyone from the island of Ireland is considered Irish, after all, regardless of where their taxes go. But the Republic of Ireland isn't associated with the UK at all, anymore. Only Northern Ireland is. Anyway, let's set all that aside. Point being, if we seek to understand matters of war and peace, trade and immigration, the sorts of things I have in mind when I refer vaguely to interactions between states, While we may find it useful at times to take account of cultural groupings, we must first and foremost be mindful of how political authority is structured, because the policies we're interested in are chosen by the heads of state. Though, again, we're also interested in attempts of non-state actors to influence some of those policies, and even to redraw maps by establishing new states or merging existing ones together. What does that leave out, then? Aside from the really obvious stuff, like when the universe began and who actually wrote Shakespeare's plays, a great deal, actually, even within the realm of politics. IR does not concern itself, directly at least, with national or subnational elections, which really should go by another name, because, again, a nation is a cultural grouping, while a state is a political entity, but that's what everyone calls them. If you're interested in knowing who the next president of the United States will be, well, so am I, but that's outside the scope of IR. Not outside the scope of political science, which may or may not be considered the broader field to which IR belongs, but outside the scope of IR. Similarly, if you're interested in debates about whether and when resort to war is morally justified, the history of political thought, or discourse analysis, you've got to look elsewhere. That's not to say these aren't important questions, just that IR can't give you any answers. Put differently, as it says at the top of the third slide, the focus of international relations, and thus of this module, is on understanding the way the world is, rather than debating how it should be. That doesn't mean no one should care about the latter sorts of questions, just that you won't hear my thoughts on them. And frankly, I've no interest in yours. Sorry. Okay, a few more practical points about what you can expect from this module before I introduce the two big puzzles we'll be returning to throughout the term. I will do my best to illustrate abstract concepts with concrete examples, be they historical or contemporary, but I will only do so for that purpose. I'm not here to teach you the history of the international system or to compel you to read the newspaper. You'll find a few questions on each exam related to either history or current events, primarily as softballs, but what I really hope to impart, and what I'll be looking to see if you've picked up, is a broader understanding of how the world works. You see that funny word on the slide there, generalizable? That's fancy academic talk for the property of being applicable to settings other than the one in which it was originally developed. If I were to dedicate a few weeks of this module to the history of World War I, for example, it's not clear that, at the end of term, you'd have any better sense of, say, why the US and the UK went to war with Iraq in 2003. Because most of what I'd have to say wouldn't be generalizable. It might be more interesting, alas, I'm well aware that many of you would prefer story time to abstract arguments, especially those that are expressed even partially in the language of mathematics, but there is a reason for it, and it's not that I'm a sadist. The reason you are going to see a fair amount of game theory and statistical analysis in this module, don't worry if you've no earthly clue what either of those are yet, I'll cover everything you need to know in future lectures, is that I want to offer you generalizable answers to the two big puzzles we're about to discuss, and those happen to be very useful tools for ensuring that the answers I present to you will in fact be generalizable. My hope is that those of you who really try to get the most out of this module, who listen to all the lectures multiple times if need be, and genuinely grapple with what will at times be challenging material, will be able to open up a newspaper a year or two or 10 from now and understand the things you're reading about better than your peers. I may or may not succeed in convincing you that reading about the particulars of specific historical or current events is not the best way to achieve that goal, but I hope you at least appreciate that it is, in fact, what I'm after. Okay, just a few more words about the math stuff and we can move on. As it says on the slide, you will not be assessed on the basis of your mathematical ability. If you wish to do well in this module, however, you will need to demonstrate more than a superficial understanding of the assumptions and implications of the theoretical arguments I will present to you, as well as the empirical evidence presented in support thereof. don't understand what I mean by theoretical and empirical? That's okay. I'll go into that more in the very next lecture. The point for now is, you don't need to do any maths yourself. But I have done a fair amount in preparing this module, and if you tune out every time I start talking about it, you're going to have a problem. At least, assuming you care about your marks, which I'm sure most of you do. I know the material I'll be presenting doesn't come naturally to most people. Really, I do. I also know that I'm a bit of a speed talker. I can't help it. That's one of the reasons I record these lectures beforehand. Listen to them more than once if you need to. Stop and rewind if I move on to the next point while you're still digesting something. Ask questions. Do that in class, or by email, or in my office. I'm here to help. But you're going to have to put in some effort of your own. There's no assigned reading, nor lengthy writing requirements. And that's not because I'm nice. It's because I expect you to spend a lot of time with the lectures. If you do, you shouldn't have any trouble doing well, no matter how maths-averse you are. Okay, enough about that. Let's talk about something substantive. Advance to the fourth slide. The first big question we'll tackle this term is, why isn't there more cooperation between states? And I'm willing to bet that some of you are thinking right now, that's a stupid question. Countries don't always cooperate because it's not always in their interest to do so. You'd have to be naive to expect anything different. Fair enough, hypothetical student who may or may not speak for many of your classmates. I understand where that reaction comes from. In fact, it was my own reaction years ago as I sat in a classroom listening to some professor ask more or less the same question I just put forward to you. But I've come to realize that it's not a trivial question at all. That the sort of answer that springs readily to mind, at least for some students, is woefully inadequate. I'm not going to convince you of that today, not fully, but I hope to at least get you thinking, to sow the seeds of doubt. In subsequent lectures, I'll present a much stronger case that money is being left lying on the ground, so to speak, that there are forms of cooperation that would benefit all parties, at least if we conceive of states as unitary actors, more on that later, that aren't occurring. The point isn't to bemoan that fact, mind you, it's to explain it, which I believe I can, but first I have to convince you that there's a puzzle there to be explained. As I've said, I don't expect to do that today, but I'll start us down that path. As the slide says, there are two important things to note. First, cooperation between states that are bitter rivals is surprisingly common. As common as cooperation between strong allies? No, of course not. But still more common than you might think. Too common for it's a dog-eat-dog world, why on earth would you expect there to be more cooperation to pass the laugh test? Second, the nature of the international system is essentially constant. That is, it hasn't changed much in hundreds of years. But the level of cooperation that obtains within said system is quite variable. As we'll discuss more in a future lecture, you can't explain variables with constants. If you leave for class in the morning, for example, and your flat is clean, then come home to find it a mess, the natural thing to do is ask, what happened? Because something did. It had to have. If your mate tells you, well, you're not the tidiest person I've ever met, you're going to glare at them, because that's not only rude, it's also completely irrelevant. However tidy a person you are or aren't, that didn't change while you were on campus for one day. Pointing to deep-rooted fundamental properties, be it of a person or a state or a system, often isn't very helpful. Yet for some reason, when dealing with big abstractions like international politics or the global economy, a lot of people find it very tempting to do so, even though they seldom do in their daily lives. If you're the sort of person that tends to do this, I'm not trying to shame you, but I am trying to make you aware of the limitations of that reflex. Okay, just a little more detail to back up that initial two-part defense. Did you know that the top three trade partners for the United States are Canada, predictably, China, and Mexico? Yet no one thinks the US and China are best friends. In fact, a lot of people are concerned that there might be a war between those two states sometime this century. And I think they're right to be worried, as I'll discuss in a later lecture. The point is, a lot of people in Washington see China as a rival and would love to see China's rise come to an immediate halt. Yet that doesn't prevent the US from cooperating with China economically, and in lots of other ways. So when we look at pairs of states that don't cooperate as much as they could, it's fair to ask why they don't. And the answer can't be as trite as, well, they're enemies, and everyone knows you don't cooperate with your enemy, because everyone doesn't know that. Sometimes, oftentimes, states do cooperate with their enemies. Which leads us to the next point. Wartime suspension of trade is a lot less common than you think. It happens, to be sure. Typically, states that go to war with one another see a temporary drop in trade that fully recovers shortly after the war. But there are a number of instances where it didn't even slow down. That, too, poses a real challenge to the reflexive, "why the heck would they?" response that some people give. Recall that one of my arguments was that you can't explain variables with constants. If it is true that the international system forces all states to look out for themselves, an idea I actually think has some merit, more on that later, well, that's been true for a long time. The stylized, if a bit problematic, claim that some of you may have heard is that the international system as we know it today was essentially created by the Peace of Westphalia all the way back in 1648. One can quibble with that, but either way, we've seen dramatic fluctuations in the level of international cooperation since then. Focusing again on economic cooperation, global trade grew by about 2,700% between 1950 and 2005, as it says on the slide. 2,700. That's, a lot. By way of analogy, if you are 5'4", the average height of a British female, and your height were to increase by 2,700%, you'd then be nearly 150 feet tall. Did the international system change fundamentally between 1950 and 2005? Not really. Some important things did change, yes, and that's of course part of the story, but the fundamental nature of it? Nope. The other big question is, why isn't there less conflict between states? In principle, this argument applies to all forms of conflict, from diplomatic rows and economic sanctions on up, but we're mostly going to focus on armed conflict, as in war. Here, too, some of you might think there's an obvious answer, and I'm going to argue again that it's unsatisfactory. It may or may not be true that human beings are, by our very nature, violent and greedy and short-sighted, territorial and intolerant. It's not clear to me that anyone really knows what human nature is, but that's besides the point. I'm challenging conventional wisdom enough here as it is. The point is, it doesn't even matter whether any of that is true. It still doesn't explain our puzzle. How not? Well, as before, we have two key facts we have to confront. The first is that war is much rarer than people realize. Not as rare as it should be, perhaps, if you're the bleeding heart type, but still far too rare for "people suck" to be any sort of explanation for what we observe when we look at the historical record. And, as before, we have the problem of constants being unable to explain variables. Let's flesh out each of these arguments, starting with the rarity of war. The mistake most people make here is that they think about the numerator without regard to the denominator. For the less mathematically inclined, that means people think about how often war occurs overall in sheer numbers, without factoring in how often it could have occurred, but didn't. That's a natural mistake, sure, but still a mistake. An analogy may help here. If you're like most millennials, you've got an account on Facebook. and unless you have far fewer friends than most people, you're notified by Facebook about a friend's birthday almost every day. Even just within your personal circle of friends, it's always someone's birthday. Does that mean birthdays are common? Well, that's a strange notion. They literally only come around once a year. Unbirthdays are unambiguously the default setting. Thank you, Lewis Carroll. For any given person, 99.7% of the time, it is not their birthday. Except those freaks who were born on the last day of February during a leap year, but let's not worry about them. The same goes for war. Yes, at any given time, somewhere in the world, there's probably a war taking place. In unlucky years, more than one. But so what? Think about how many not wars there are. One way to think about that is by focusing on all the instances of near wars. That's what MIDs are. See the top bullet point on the last slide. MID stands for Militarized Interstate Dispute. The Correlates of War Project, which we'll talk about again later in the module, collects data on wars and instances that could have become wars. A MID takes place whenever a state threatens to use force against another state, shows force, say by mobilizing troops to the border, testing a bomb, or violating airspace, or uses force. That's a pretty high threshold of hostility. Most of the time, most states are not engaged in any MIDs. But there were more than 2,500 of them between 1816 and 2010, the last year for which data is available as of this recording. 2,500 times states threatened to go to war explicitly or engaged in extremely threatening acts. Yet fewer than 100 of those disputes actually turned into wars. That's not a lot. Yes, from a humanitarian perspective, that's nearly 100 wars too many. But the point is, most of the time, states find other ways of resolving their differences. Tensions between states are not rare. They're not exactly the default. Most states tend to get along with the rest of the world pretty dang well, thank you very much. But they're not rare either. Wars, however, are rare. Fewer than 4% of MIDs become wars. That is, more than 95% of the time, when states get so mad at each other that they threaten to drop bombs, call up the reserves, or maybe even fire a few warning shots, no one dies. So the fact that they sometimes do is a real puzzle. And we need more than trite cliches to solve that puzzle. We need an explanation for war that would both explain why dead bodies do sometimes pile up, but also lead us to expect that most of the time, they won't. Preferably, an explanation that can even tell us which sorts of disputes are the most prone to becoming wars. It won't surprise you to hear, after all of that, that I've got just such an explanation. A couple of them, in fact. And we'll explore them in detail later on. For now, let me just close by giving another way to think about the puzzle. Look at the graph at the bottom of the slide. It shows the percentage of states in the international system that were involved in at least one war of any kind, interstate, intrastate, and extrastate. I'll define those in a subsequent lecture, for each year between 1817 and 2007. Two things should jump out at you. The same two things I've already highlighted. First, overall, the frequency of war is pretty low. There was one year in the 1800s when an actual majority of states were involved in wars of some kind, but only one. For the last 60 years or so, less than 20% of states have been at war at any given time. That is, more than 80%, sometimes 90%, of countries have been at peace in almost every year since the 1950s. That's a lot of peace, considering how terrible human nature allegedly is. The other thing that should jump out at you is that we're not looking at a flat line. The rate of war goes up and down, sometimes quite dramatically. an explanation for war that can't account for that variation, even superficially, is not much of an explanation. People didn't suddenly turn violent in 1939 any more than they became greedy for the first time in 2007. So the outbreak of a war that eventually came to involve most of the world's countries can't be attributed to warmongerism any more than the global recession of 2008 can be blamed on greedy banks. If you're the sort of person who's drawn to such explanations, well, you've signed up for the right module.